Is there ever such a thing as a good war? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author. With me are my colleagues throughout this quarter, Alden Thompson and Dave Thomas, my colleagues at Walla Walla University. And this question of war, I don't think there's ever such a thing as good war, perhaps, but can there be a war that has good results? Can there be a war that is, when it's done, people are glad it took place?
Well, the fact that war in heaven, I don't know what that means, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but Scripture says that there was war in heaven.
Yeah, and you know, the process of war is almost universally destructive. But once in a while, the outcome of the war does improve circumstance. A lot of the time, war simply makes people tired. They don't fight anymore, and their grudges go underground again. But once in a while, a war does remove evil and replace it with something else.
Sometimes the tensions last long after. We're looking at Revelation 12 today, and Alden, as you mentioned, war in heaven. Chapter 12 begins with some symbols. It actually says straight up there were signs, symbols. The first one is a woman. She's clothed with the sun, moon under her feet, crown of 12 stars. She's pregnant. She gives birth to a male child. It says that there's also another sign, a great dragon, and the dragon wants to eat her child. I can't imagine having, instead of a loving, caring doctor there to catch the child, a fire-breathing dragon in this case.
Does it say fire-breathing?
Yeah. When we go back to Job chapter 41, it talks about a fire-breathing dragon in the sea, that this certainly seems to be a Leviathan-type creature. But we know by reading a little further down, it says who this is. It says this dragon is the ancient serpent, the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole earth, and he wants to devour the male child. From your understanding of the way this passage has normally been interpreted, who is the woman and who is the child? Do you have a sense?
Well, the traditional interpretation, which I think is fairly straightforward, is that the woman is the church and the child is Jesus Christ.
And when Jesus is born, he's caught up
there was an attempt to destroy him.
There was.
Yeah.
And did Satan come right out and just show up at his door? Ready to kill the child? Ready to...
Well, no, he used an agent, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah, that actually seems to be the pattern throughout both Daniel and Revelation. The controversy doesn't play out with God and Satan specifically showing their faces.
No. And, you know, this is an interesting chapter, Brent, because it's one of the... It reminds me of Daniel chapter 2, where it has a vast panoramic view of history, that here you see... the conflict between good and evil played out, and not just in this moment, but the picture in Revelation 12 is broader than that.
Yeah. It certainly is broader than that, and it says that this male child who would rule the nations with a rod of iron, kind of hearkening back to the second psalm, Psalm 2, if you haven't read that in association with Revelation 12, it makes some sense. But it says the child was caught up to God in his throne, maybe an indication of the ascension of Christ, his victory over Satan. And then the woman runs away. But then it says there's war in heaven. And now I have heard multiple perspectives on this war in heaven. Some Adventists have said, and even people of other faiths, say that this is war that happened before there was even a world, a creation of earth. Others have said that in the context of Revelation 12, there is a specific war that's taking place because of the victory of Christ on this earth. And at his ascension, he went to heaven and threw the devil out once and for all. Have you heard either of both of these? Do you have a preference for one?
Well, I don't think I've ever heard the second one. I've always heard the first one. That's okay. Why I mentioned that it seems to me this is a panoramic vision of history.
Mm.
But it does strike me in the moment that this vision occurs well after the birth of Jesus, does it not?
It does. And it seems somewhat tied to that event, right?
Yeah.
The birth of Jesus, his ascension, and now there's war in heaven and Satan loses his place.
Yeah. No, I guess I've tended to follow the old Protestant idea that the war in heaven is subsequent to the original appearance of sin, and that Lucifer was cast out with the wicked angels, and that sets up the story of history.
Okay,
But there is a fascinating wrinkle here. First off, we would say that this is the first time that the serpent is identified as Satan. You look at Genesis 3, the serpent is just simply the most subtle creature which the Lord God had made.
Right.
But here it's quite clear that he is the devil. And if you read it through, I think one could make a good case for saying there was a primeval war, but continues on with the punchline coming at the cross. If we go on, for instance, it says where he was thrown down with him, "Then I heard a loud voice," this is verse 10, "proclaiming, now have come salvation, the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our comrades has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. But they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they did not cling to life even in the face of death. Rejoice then, you heavens, and those who dwell in them, but woe to earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you with great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." So that one clearly pinpoints it at the time of the cross, because they've conquered him by the blood of the Lamb. So I think what we would have to say, if you want to make cosmology out of this, we would have to say that Satan had access to the heavenly courts, as he did in Job, until the cross. At that point, he was effectively limited to the earth.
And
was tossed out at that point.
And thus, the people of earth now have a new experience. We can overcome by the blood of the Lamb. It isn't our job to go fight Satan directly. We overcome through Christ's victory on the cross, or we claim that victory. I find you mentioned Job, Alden. It's an interesting point. I've just been looking at that book again this last week. And there, Job doesn't know fully what's going on in the courts of heaven, but it says that there is an accuser that stands against God. And there the name Satan, Ha-Satan, the Satan, the accuser, is his name there. It's not so much a name as it is a description of his character, right? The Satan, it's a being in heaven who accuses God, and in the end incites God, even he would say, against Job. Here then, that being, that accuser, is finally kicked out of heaven once and for all.
But in Job, only the reader and the author know about the accuser.
Job is unaware.
Yeah, Job is unaware, and that's the way evil is in this world. All we see is the evil, and we can't identify clearly who the actors are behind it. But Job gives us permission to say there is an evil, an accuser, who is behind all evil and is an opponent of God.
And not only is an opponent to God, but makes it sound as if God's to blame for all of it, in Job at least.
That's right.
Job only serves you because you've put a hedge around him. Job only serves you because you protect him personally. Let me take those things away, and it'll show that you're unworthy to be loved. So perhaps this great panoramic picture, Dave, as you had mentioned, this panoramic picture includes the Old Testament aspects. At some point, though, you would think that God would want to bring an end to the serpent, to the devil, to his reign. Perhaps it's happening in stages. And at the cross, something happened. And now it says he's come down to earth and we have a short time. What does it mean that he's angry and woe to the earth? He has a short time left. How is it possible that God would send him here and then say, well, earth, do your best now. He's got a short time, but I'm going to let him loose on you for a bit. Does it feel that way sometimes?
Well, that's not hard to agree with, Brent. That statement's not hard to agree with. I mean,
it may be hard to accept.
Well, it's hard, you know. It's difficult when you look at all the news and all the terrible things that are happening to know whether the frequency of evil is greater now or whether the reporting of evil is just more comprehensive.
Uh-huh.
You know, is it just that it's like earthquakes. We used to know only about the big ones. Now you have seismographs that any little tremble anywhere in the world gets counted. The news media today reports on all kinds of things that I'm not sure would have made it in years gone by. But I think that this is one part of Christian doctrine I think is empirically provable, that there is evil in the world, you know.
Who would deny it?
Well, it's very hard to deny it. Only people who, I don't know who would deny it. I certainly wouldn't.
Yeah, there's a lot of pain, there's suffering, there's loss. Verse 10, though, Alden, you read this, "Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come." So something happened at the cross. Something happened with the death of Jesus that changes human experience forever.
Well, some theologians, and I forget the name or who did this, but they compared the cross, drew an analogy between the war between good and evil and the Second World War, saying that the cross was like D-Day, where the once the Allied armies had a beachhead in France, historians say there was no real doubt as to the final outcome of the war. It went on for another year or 9 months, whatever. But there was no doubt about the outcome, and the cross is like that in the controversy between good and evil. Since the cross, we have no doubt about what the final outcome will be. It's merely a matter of seeing this, if we call it a fight or war, to a conclusion.
And in this sense, the devil even knows the outcome, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's already aware. It's like the Axis powers in Germany knowing they've lost their strength.
But that's when your true colors come out, on both sides, by the way.
Huh.
Well, the text here in Revelation says they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. So as far as the saints are concerned, they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb.
It's done, what Christ has done. And the word of their testimony may be saying, here's what Christ has done with me, through me, in me. He has given me that victory as well. The passage continues that this woman who gave birth to the male child is chased into the wilderness. Some have suggested this was the church in the Dark Ages. What's interesting is we're going to see in chapter 16 a woman in the wilderness again. We will see, but it's not a woman who looks like this. It describes her clothing. It says she has children, much like this woman does, but she's very different. So something happens in the wilderness to the church, if this is indeed the church. But then at the conclusion of this chapter, it says the dragon was enraged with the woman, but he went off to make war with the rest of her offspring, her children, who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Seventh-day Adventists have found a kind of a self-identity in this verse. Are we right to do so, or is this broader than just a self-Adventist self-identification? These people who keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus, is this the Ten Commandments and spirit of prophecy, or is this more than just that?
Well, bearing their witness to Jesus and keeping the Ten Commandments, that's in the Seventh-day Adventist name, the seventh day, which affirms our commitment to the law, and Second Advent, which affirms our commitment to Jesus.
Both of those seem to fit, but...
I wouldn't want to limit it to Adventists only. I think there are other people who do that too.
And that's maybe the point. Yeah, we come to the end of this chapter with an affirmation, the commandments of God, the testimony of Jesus. This is for all people. Our time is up for today. I want to thank you for joining us and the good word to my conversation partners, Dave and Alden, and also to Jared Miller, our sound engineer. Grateful for his help. Thank you for listening to The Good Word. I'm Brent Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.